3 weeks from tonight will be the first Seder, not to scare anybody, but about right now, 3 weeks from tonight, we'll be preparing for the first Seder. So we're going to have three classes this week, next week, and the week after that, studying the Haggadah. This week's going to be a little more of an introduction to the Haggadah, and maybe at the end we'll get to the real text. The following 2 weeks, we're going to actually study a lot of the text of the Haggadah itself. So if you have your own Haggadah you could bring in, that'd be great. I'll have extra Haggadahs I could bring in as well. But I want to just do 2 points of introduction before we jump right into the Haggadah, an introduction to the Haggadah. And one is, that you see on the sheet, one is the importance of preparing for holidays. We're in 30 days of the holidays, and there is an obligation, the real mitzvah by Pesach, to begin preparing 30 days before the holiday. By other holidays, Sukkot and Shavuot, there's a question, maybe a week is good, maybe 2 weeks are good. By Pesach, there's a real mitzvah to begin preparing for 30 days before the holiday. Then we're preparing physically, then we're preparing spiritually, because Pesach, probably out of all the holidays, has the most prep involved.
Really?
Whether it means... everyone has different reactions to that one. Meaning Shavuos... Shavuos, you have to figure out what type of cheesecake to make. That's as long as... So that takes 1-2 days, maybe. Even Sukkot, that takes prep. You buy a little of an esrog from the shul, you put up a sukkah. Pesach, of course, has so many rules, so many things you have to prepare for, including spiritual, including the Seder night as well. So I once heard a parable, a mushel, from Ephraim Waxman. He's a rabbi in Muncie. Ray Stuart Laser, actually, if anyone was here for one of our Portraits of Greatness class, he spoke about Ephraim Waxman. So I once heard a beautiful mushel, a parable, about the importance of preparing for holidays. So imagine the following scene. He said, you have two neighbors, live on the same street. One, a very, very wealthy, successful businessman. Large house, fancy cars, successful business. And next to him, unfortunately, you had a person who had hard times, very poor, poverty-stricken, had a broken-down car, a broken-down house. You can open the door if you want. And so these two neighbors were friendly. They were very different.
Sorry.
I could, yeah. Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. Welcome.
Thank
you. So back to our story, if everyone forgot the story. So you have two people next to neighbors to each other, one a very, very wealthy man, one a poverty-stricken man. And they're always talking. Over the years, they become very friendly. And one day, when the poor man, the poverty-stricken man, is speaking to his wealthy neighbor, he says, I'm so jealous of your life. Every morning I see you get picked up in this fancy limousine. They take you to these fancy restaurants for all these meetings. You meet with these very high, powerful politicians, businessmen. You go a fancy breakfast, a fancy lunch, a fancy dinner. You have very nice suits. I'm so jealous. I wish that I could have one day in your life. One day in your life, that's my dream. So the wealthy man thought it was a little bit funny, humorous, and they went on their merry way. A few weeks later, the wealthy man told his friend, his neighbor, you're in luck, because in 2 weeks from now, my secretary overbooked me, double booked me, and I have to go overseas for a business deal. My secretary overbooked me, and I also have a meeting, a very important meeting, 2 weeks from now in town, and I can't go to both. And the meeting in town is some foreign Chinese businessman coming to meet me. They don't know what I look like. So you can actually fill in for me. I want you to fill in for me. They don't know what I look like. Maybe it was before the days of social media. They have no idea who I am. 2 weeks from today, it's a Monday, 2 weeks from today, you're going to fill in for me. And the man got very, very excited. Finally, his dream was going to come true. Everything he always thought about for years, he's finally going to have that day. And a few days pass, a week passes, and the wealthy man reminds his friend, you should know, a week from now, 9 a.m., the limo is coming, you have to be ready. He says, yeah, I'm so excited, that's all I'm thinking about. Then Wednesday comes and he reminds him, you should know, 2 days from now, it's time, you're going to take my place for the day. And of course, he's excited. Finally, Monday morning comes, 8:30, and the poor man comes out and is just sitting there waiting for the limo to come. And his wealthy neighbor turns to him and says, where's your suit? You're going to a very, very high, powerful meeting with these Chinese foreign businessmen. Where's your suit? And he said, oh my God, I don't have a suit. I didn't buy a suit. So the wealthy man said, you didn't buy a suit? Just take my suit. Quickly grab one. And the wealthy man was much bigger than him, so he put on the suit. It was way too big. The pants were going down. And then the poor man said, oh, I have to go shave. I have to take a haircut. And the wealthy man said, it's coming in 5 minutes, the limo. You have no time for that. So all of a sudden, the limo comes. This poor man goes into the limo. He's wearing this suit way too big for him. He's not shaving. He doesn't have a haircut. The limo driver is laughing at him. And this person is so embarrassed. He gets into the limo, and the limo driver says, do you want the coffee? You know, you could open up the fridge. You want a bottle of water? So he takes a bottle of water, pulls out his wallet, preparing to pay the driver. And the limo driver says, you don't need to pay me. You paid for the limo. It comes with the water. He was so, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize. And the day did not start off well. Then he finally goes to this lunch with the Chinese businessman. And they go to a fancy Italian restaurant. And the whole menu is in Italian. And this person has no idea how to read Italian. So he orders dessert for the appetizer. And he orders the appetizer for dessert. And he orders a steak that's too raw. And he hates it. And he's spitting it out. And finally they start talking about business. And he has no idea what's flying. He doesn't know what a stock is. He doesn't know what a bond is. And the whole day, he was just so embarrassed. And he went home that night. And finally, his friend came back a few days later. And the poor man said, I don't know what you enjoy, but it's really not that's all cracked up to be. I had the worst day of my life. I was embarrassed all day. They looked at me like I was from a different planet. I was all disheveled. Your life is miserable. And the poor man turned to his friend and said, you fool. If you would have just put in a little preparation beforehand, you would have had the best day of your life. If you would have bought a suit, just took a haircut, learned a little Italian, asked me what restaurant you were going to, looked up Wikipedia what stocks were, you would have had the best day of your life. But you didn't prepare. And so the whole day felt so far into you, it was miserable. That's the parable. And Rabbi Waxman said, so often we go through holidays and we look at our neighbor across the street and they're enjoying, they're having a great time. And we go through a Shabbos, we go through a holiday, and it's miserable for us. It's long, the rabbi's speaking for too long, the prayers are too long, the meals are too long, maybe those aren't too long. But everything, the text we're reading for at the Haggadah is in a different language, literally it's in Hebrew, I have no idea what's going on. And we go through the holidays and we don't enjoy it. It's miserable for us. So Rabbi Waxman explained that perhaps one of the reasons is we don't put in the preparation. If you fall into a holiday without any preparation, there's a very good chance it's going to be miserable. If you come into Pesach and you don't know which way to hold the Haggadah, and you don't know what we're doing, why am I eating the matzo? How many cups of wine am I drinking? And you're trying to learn on the fly, and it's literally a foreign language to us, so it's going to be a miserable experience. But if you put in preparation, for sure, for Pesach, which has so many different beautiful facets to it, if you put in preparation, that can make the holiday so much more beautiful, so much more meaningful. And that was his urge and his encouragement to prepare. That's what we're going to try to do for the next 3 weeks in this class. But again, this class is only about 35, 40 minutes or so. So everyone's encouraged on their own, whatever that means, to prepare. Whether it means picking up an English Haggadah and reading through it, listening to classes, thinking about Pesach, the more and more we prepare, the more and more it'll be a very enjoyable holiday. So that's just one brief introduction about the importance of preparing. That's number one. Number two, another parable, another mashal. Because there's a famous question, a well-known question, from Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa. Yaakov of Lisa was a big rabbi about 200 years ago. He wrote a very famous work that studied in the yeshivas called the Nesivos HaMishpat. It's a commentary on the Gemara, a very, very famous work. And he's very troubled, why are we even celebrating Pesach? What are we commemorating on Pesach? He gives the following mashal, another parable. He says, imagine you have a person who is sitting in jail for a long time. He was wrongfully convicted. He didn't hire David Robbins, and he was put into jail for something he didn't do. And he's sitting there for 10 years. Finally, he gets out of prison. So you can imagine how happy he is that day. And every year when the anniversary comes around, imagine how happy he is. He's celebrating every year the day he finally got out of prison. But imagine if 20 years later again, something happens and he gets thrown back into prison, this time a life sentence. So do you think that when he's in prison the second time, he's going to still be commemorating the first time he got out of prison? When he's free, so every year he throws a big party. This is the day I got out of jail. But if he gets thrown back in prison for a life sentence, it will be pretty ridiculous for him to be celebrating his previous freedom. He's back in jail. So what are you celebrating? No one would celebrate while you're sitting in jail the time 10 years ago where I got taken out of jail. So as Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa, that seems like what we're doing in Pesach. We're thanking Hashem for taking us out of an exile that was 210 years, a bitter exile where we got murdered, and Paro killed our children, and he made us work hard. So I get when we're sitting in Israel with the temple, and we're free, and we're at peace, that we celebrate Pesach. But we're sitting in the middle of a 2,000-year exile where the exact same things are happening. We're still being killed. We're still not at peace. We're still not in control of our own destiny. So how is it any different than the person in jail, who's in jail a second time, celebrating his freedom the first time? What are we celebrating on Pesach? We're celebrating getting out of Egypt. We're thrown right back into exile. Why are we celebrating leaving Egypt when we're seemingly in an exile much, much worse than the exile in Egypt was? What are we doing in the entire Pesach? What are we celebrating on Pesach? What do you think? This is an open-ended question. What do you think? Very good, beautiful.
Could you repeat that, please?
She said that because Hashem redeemed us once, it shows that He could redeem us again in the future. So we're not really celebrating, saying, that event, leaving Egypt, but that Hashem loves us and has the power to take us out again. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, very good.
Yeah. It's the whole thing. When you talk about the person in prison, then it's like, okay, I had this one time. Then there's a possibility that I can get it again, and that I can be delivered, I can be free, and this time it'll be even more. And also, I believe that you want to appreciate it even more. It's more in depth, it's more deeper, because it's like, okay, no more three times. You know, this first time, I must have didn't do any, that guy.
Next time is the last time.
Yeah, so this is it. So
right, beautiful.
This, I have to get in there and I have to give it all.
Beautiful.
So I guess that's what it is for us now, is to give it all.
You want to know what Reverend Bridgewood says?
Please. Mm-hmm. She might be over in 5 minutes if you say.
He says it revolves around the definition of Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim also has not just the word being in Egypt, but it's also a binding of ourselves. So he said, actually, one of the things we're celebrating is how do we unbind ourselves to all the things that we're chained to, whether
personally holding us back with all our limitations.
Whatever it is that's holding you back, okay, or whatever it is that you're thinking about that you know, you would like to get rid of, then that's one of the things that you discuss. Not
beautiful.
It's hard to, you know, believe you're a prisoner, to imagine that we're prisoners or slaves.
Right.
But he said personal Mitzrayim, that's what he said.
Very good. Beautiful. Anyone else?
A lot of the holidays center around the kids and families, so I was thinking maybe to teach the kids the connection between the Jewish people and Hashem.
Meaning, again, not celebrating the historical leaving of Egypt, but the fact that we have a connection and all the lessons of Pesach. Beautiful. Okay, very good. Very, very smart class. Very good. We can end now, but we'll continue just to make me happy. But so let's look now quickly. We'll go through the first couple of sources. The first one is in Hebrew, so I'll translate in English as well. This is from the Sefer Mitzvos Kakatan. There are many different rabbis in the medieval period who wrote books trying to count the different mitzvos. There's a tradition we have. How many mitzvos are there in the Torah? 613. So how did you get to that number? That's very, very complicated. It's not clear how did you get to that number 613. So there are many books written. The Rambam, Maimonides wrote one, trying to figure out what are the 613. So one of these works is called the Sefer Mitzvos HaKatan. In English, literally, the small book of mitzvos. Why is there a book called the Sefer Mitzvos HaKatan, the small book of mitzvos? Because there's another book called Sefer Mitzvos HaGadol, the large book of mitzvos. So he wrote the Sefer Mitzvos HaKatan. And he's dealing with the question that the first of the Aseret HaDibros, the first of the Ten Commandments is what? Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, your God, Asher Tzitzichem Eretz Mitzrayim, it took you out of Egypt. And some of the commentators count that as the first mitzvah. And others, like the Rambam, are very troubled. Where is the mitzvah there? Take a lulav and shake it, that's a mitzvah, something I could do. Don't speak Lashon Hara, that's a mitzvah, I could do it. But how can you count the first commandment, I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt? How is that one of the 613? Where is there a commandment? How do I fulfill that commandment?
By remembering.
Just remembering it. But where does it say to remember? It just says, I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt. So he's saying just remember. It's sort of like what we do in Parsha Zachor by Amalek. Remember what happened, that fulfilled the mitzvah. Okay, good. So let's look now at source number one. So we'll jump where it's underlined. I'm going to translate because it only has the Hebrew. The Al-Karchani says, it must be, what is this mitzvah of, I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt? Ma'achar shehu dibor, because it's one of the commandments, hachi ka'amar, this is what the mitzvah is. Kishem sh'ani rotze sh'ta'aminu bi, just like I want you to believe in me, sh'ani hotzeithi etchem, just like I want you to believe in me, and Mrs. Brummer said, believe, you have to believe that I took you out of Egypt, just like I want you to believe you took me out of Egypt, Kach ani rotze, so too I want you, shetaminu, to believe, shani Hashem Elokeichem, that I am Hashem your God, v'ani ati lekabetz etchem, that I have the power to redeem you from all of your pain in the future as well, ulehoshiachem, and to save them. So says the Sefer Mitzvot HaKatan, the first mitzvah in the Torah of remembering that I am Hashem took you out of Egypt, really the goal is that just like Hashem took us out of Egypt, so too He has the power and He will save us again. And so that's perhaps the first answer to the question, which is what you said. When we're celebrating leaving Mitzrayim, of course we're commemorating a historical event. That's true. But also what we're celebrating is looking prospectively into the future. And that's why, if you look, I will see in the class, and hopefully you'll see in your own, so much of the Haggadah, very strangely, is speaking about the ultimate redemption. The end of the Seder, we sing, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. It seems like an odd place to say that. Why are we saying that in the middle of speaking about Egypt? We pour a fifth cup, the Koshel Eliyahu. Why? Why are we speaking so much about the future redemption throughout the entire Seder, throughout the entire Haggadah? So instead of Yaakov of Lisa, that's the reason, that's why we're celebrating Pesach. That just like Hashem had the power to redeem us from Egypt in the past, He also has the power, and He will, we believe, redeem us in the future. And I think this year, for sure, with everything going on, right in the middle of it, that's something we could appreciate it. We're not only celebrating a historical event in the past, but we're expecting and we're praying that God save us from all of our harm. That is answer number one. Good. Let's go now to source number two. And this is also what we said. Mrs. Raff said also. Because we'll see the Seder night is the night, perhaps the most important night of the year, where we pass on tradition to our children, to our friends, to our family, to our spouse, to our neighbors. That is the night to pass on our belief. If you had to pick one night of the entire year where it's so important to pass on the belief in God, it's the Leil HaSeder, it's Pesach night. And the Ramban is going to tell us, in source number two, you have the English also, that when we celebrate leaving Egypt, we're not just celebrating that God took us out of Egypt. We're celebrating all of the lessons and all that the Jewish people witnessed and learned and became from that moment. And the Ramban is bothered by the question, so many of our mitzvos are all Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim. We say Kiddush Friday night. And we end Kiddush, Zecher, as a remembrance, Yetzias Mitzrayim. We put up a mezuzah to remember Mitzrayim. We put on tefillin the man in the morning to remember Mitzrayim. What do these mitzvahs have anything to do with leaving Mitzrayim? Matzah, I get. We eat matzahs, we'll see, to remember the matzah they had in Mitzrayim. But why are there so many other mitzvahs connected to Mitzrayim? We have a mitzvah daily, every single day, to remember leaving Egypt. Why is that? Why do we have a mitzvah every single day to remember leaving Egypt?
That's where it all started.
I mean, what? Jewish people began. Mm-hmm. Good. Anyone else? Why is there a mitzvah every day to remember leaving Egypt? It was a great miracle. But there are many miracles that happened.
Well, I mean, when you think in terms of slavery and feel in terms of freedom, I feel it's a need for to pass it on for yourself to remind you, okay, this is me free and this is what I need to continue to work on. And then you also pass it on to your children.
Right.
But it's not just your children, it's the people around you.
Everyone around you, right.
Everywhere you go is what you do.
Right.
Because, you know, freedom is not free, you know, it's something, and a lot of times
you have to appreciate it.
Right. And you don't take it, you take it for granted.
Right.
So there are little things in the family.
So let's look at source number two. We have the English also. I'm going to read in Hebrew, but you can follow along, then you can turn the page. The Ramban says something beautiful. He says, "Uba avor ki HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo yasa osu mofes." Hashem throughout history is not going to do miracles constantly for us. Bechol dor, for every generation, le'enei kol rosh o kofer. Hashem is not going to provide miracles to the Jewish people in every generation. Not open miracles. In our current state, fighting Hamas, we're not expecting an open miracle to happen. That's not how God runs the world. And throughout Jewish history, most of Jewish history, there was no open miracles. God does not perform open miracles to the Jewish people whenever they're in trouble. And therefore, Yitzaveh Osana, He commanded us, Shenaseh Tomet Zikaravos, you better remember, constantly remember, La'asher Ra'o Einenu, remember what happened in Mitzrayim. Because Mitzrayim, Hashem openly revealed Himself more than any other time in history. Hashem did the 10 plagues, the 10 makos. Supernatural things. Hashem split the sea. There were no other times in history, like in the leaving of Egypt, where Hashem showed Himself so in front of our eyes so naturally that Hashem runs the world. And it doesn't happen often. And since then, it really never happened since, in that open of a way. And therefore, he commanded us, v'natik ha'davar el b'neinu, be very, very careful to pass it on to the next generation. U'b'neim l'b'neim, and them to their next generation. And then again, u'b'neim b'dor achron, for all of Jewish history, to remember what happened. V'hechmir ma'od b'inin hazeh, Hashem was so strict about this. Kimo shechayev karis b'achilas chametz. You eat bread on Pesach, it's a very severe penalty. Bread is kosher the rest of the year. It has the best hechshir in the world. You eat a bagel on Pesach, it's a very severe penalty. The rules on Pesach, as we said, are much more strict than the rest of the year. The prep that we do before Pesach to get rid of chametz, it's so much more strict than every other holiday. Why? Why did Hashem make such strict rules for Pesach? Now, some people might think that Hashem wants to torture us. That's one answer, not correct answer. So why was Hashem so strict about Pesach? Because the lessons of Pesach, Hashem has to make sure that we keep. If you had to pick one holiday that's going to preserve the Jewish people, it's Pesach. And Hashem commanded us to remember, v'hitzrich shenichtov kol mashen re'elenu, make sure to write it down. Be'osim osim, al yadenu and tefillin, put it on your hands, al b'neinenu, put it on your doorways, put a mezuzah up, that we constantly remember each and every day, because Mitzrayim, leaving of Egypt and Pesach, is a fundamental of our entire religion, really. All of the Ikrei Amunah, all of the core of our beliefs, we saw in the Pesach story. Hashem rules the world. Hashem punishes the wicked. Hashem rewards the righteous. All of that was taught to us in the Pesach story, and that really is the goal of the Seder night. The goal of the Seder night, as we'll see, is trying to pass on that belief to other people. Maybe we believe, and maybe we don't need to work on it. Someone could think, I don't need to work on my belief. But Pesach, what Hashem wants is, A, of course, to work on your belief, but the goal of Pesach is to pass it on. Whether that means to our children, to our grandchildren, to a spouse, to a friend. Because all of the core beliefs that we know about Hashem were all taught at Pesach. And I want to read a letter, and then we'll go on more to the Seder. I want to read a beautiful letter. This is from Aaron Lopiansky. Aaron Lopiansky is a big rabbi in Silver Spring, Maryland. So he penned a letter, not a real letter. Maybe it was meant for his children, but I'm going to read parts of it, and I can send it to you after. It's a beautiful letter. He starts like this. He says, "My dear child, it is now a quiet moment late at night. After an exhausting day of Passover cleaning, you have sunk into the sweetest of sleeps, and I am sitting here with a pile of Haggadahs preparing for Seder night. Somehow, however, the words never come out the way I want them to. I never feel like I can pass over what I want to tell you at the Seder. There's so much going on. There's a lot of eating, a lot of commotion. And the Seder evening is always unpredictable. But so many thoughts and feelings are welling up in my mind, and I want to share them with you. These are the words I mean to really tell you at the Seder." And he writes like this. I'm skipping. "It is now 3,300 years since we have received that freedom in Egypt. If we imagine the average age of having a child is to be about 25 years of age, there are four generations each century. That means there are only 132 people stretching from our forefathers in Egypt until this very day. 132 people had to pass on this heritage flawlessly, with a devotion and single-mindedness that could not falter. So who were these 133 fathers of mine? One had been in the Nazi death camps. One had been whipped unconscious by Cossacks. One had children stolen by the Tsar. And one was the laughingstock of his enlightened brethren. One lived in a basement in Warsaw with many days passing with no food to his mouth. The other ran a mansion in France. One had been burned at the stake for refusing to believe in the divinity of flesh and blood. And one had been frozen to death in Siberia for continuing to believe in the divinity of the eternal God. 132 fathers, each with his own story, each with his own test of faith, and each one overriding and with a burning desire that this legacy be passed unscathed to me. And all they had is one request of me, that I pass this on to you, my sweet child." And it concludes the letter the following. He says, "I am the 133rd person in this holy chain. At times I doubt if I am passing it on well enough. I try hard, but it is hard not to quiver when you are on the vertical shoulders of 132 giants, begging you not to disappoint them by toppling everyone swaying in the wind. And this is the following paragraph, beautiful paragraph. It says, "My dear child, may God grant us many long and happy years together. But one day in the distant future, I'll be dressed in a kittel once again like tonight, as they prepare me for my burial. Try to remember that this is the treasure that I have passed on to you. And then it will be your turn. You will be the 134th with the sacred duty to pass it on to number 135. That's the letter he wrote to the child. It's a beautiful letter. But that's what the Seder night is. The Seder night is, it's not only for children. It could be for a parent. It could be for a sibling. It could be for a cousin. It could be for a neighbor. But the Seder night, more than any night of the year, is about thinking about the past, thinking about all the generations we've had in the past. We don't live in a vacuum. So many people had to have tremendous devotion to get us where we are today. For us to realize that we're Jewish and be sitting in a synagogue in Jacksonville, Florida, 2024, means that there must have been so many people that came before us that sacrificed, whether physically, financially, emotionally. And our job is, on the Seder night, is to spread that. And so perhaps the answer to the question is, what are we celebrating on Pesach? It's not just that we left Egypt. But Pesach was when we were founded as a nation. All that we know about Hashem is through Pesach. The fact that we're the Jewish people is about Pesach. So maybe the answer is that the parable was bad. We gave the parable that the person sitting in jail again. That person sitting in jail the second time won't celebrate Pesach. You know why? Because for him, that first Pesach, that first freedom of his, has no lasting impact. He's sitting in jail the second time, that first quote-unquote Pesach of his, that first run in jail, when he got freed, it meant nothing. I'm sitting back in jail. But for us, yeah, maybe we're back in exile. That doesn't mean that all the lessons we learned, all of the things that we gained to be part of the Jewish people, we still have that. And that's what the Seder is. That's what Pesach is. Pesach is passing it on to the next generation, passing it on to those around us. And that's a little bit of an introduction to the goal of Pesach and to the goal of the Seder night. Any questions? You feel free to call out any questions, comments. It's an open forum, so.
Continuity.
Right. Continuity. Both physical continuity, but also for the nation in general. Not everyone is blessed to have children, or not blessed to have children at the Seder, but there's a Jewish people. We're part of a Jewish people. That's also one of the goals of Pesach. We're not only one individual family. We're part of a Jewish people.
I thought it was interesting also, it's the only night of the year you don't say the bedtime Shema.
Right, very good. Right, as Rabbi was saying, very good. There's a halacha.
In a way, you kept talking about what all of this means, and then
right.
The only night of the entire year.
Right. There's two fascinating laws, actually. One is what Mr. Rabbi just mentioned, that many people have the practice not to say the lengthy Shema before you go to sleep. Because that bedtime Shema is meant to protect you. But the Torah says that Pesach is a Leil Shimurim, at the night of protection. Mm-hmm. And some people don't say that. Other people have a more radical one. If you're in the Talmud class, I mentioned it last week. What's the other custom? I have to put you on the spot.
What's more radical?
Let's see. Do you remember? What do people not do on Pesach night?
They keep locked the doors.
They don't lock the doors. Some people don't lock their doors on the night of Pesach.
They don't lock their
doors. Because Hashem said the night of protection, don't lock your doors. Mm-hmm. So again, I said in Tehillim Shir, I'm not going to recommend this. If I don't want to be on the line if someone's house gets robbed. So maybe one less lock, maybe if three locks do two, two do one, shut the alarm off maybe. But it's a very special night, the night of Leil Shimurim. And Mr. Rabin is very good. Pleasure having you. Okay. In what way? I mean, you feel it more? Right.
It's the war,
right, you feel it more.
It's just, like, I feel like we're really in it. Like, it might be, like, more emotional this Pesach than ever because
right.
We're just dominating so much for our right. Fellow brethren to, like, be free.
And also the first point I mentioned, the first answer of what we're celebrating is we're looking to the future, we're hoping to the future.
Yeah.
So that also can be something to focus in on, to gain inspiration from on the Seder night. Mm-hmm. It's to hope for the future, not only to think about the past, but like we said, so much of the Haggadah scattered out the whole night are references to the future. We open the door after, in the middle of the Seder, and we say a paragraph called Shefoch HaMascha, that you should pour your wrath on the nations of the world. It's a very strange custom to do in Pesach. We don't sit in the sukkah and do that. We don't open the sukkah door and beg that God pours his wrath on the nations. Maybe if we're outside, maybe it's a little more dangerous. If you're outside, maybe it's dangerous. But because that's not what Sukkot is about. The whole goal of Pesach, like we said in the first answer, was just like Hashem has the power to redeem us like He did from Egypt, He also has the ability to redeem us in the future. That's a major theme of Pesach. And that's something to connect to. If we are feeling those emotions, which we should feel, that's a major theme to connect to.
Yeah.
Very good. Fine. So those are just two brief introductions. Let's now turn the page to get actually to the Haggadah. So the first question we have to deal with, we're going to source number three, is where does the word Haggadah come from? We call it the Haggadah. Where does the word Haggadah come from? What does Haggadah mean, first of all? What does the word Haggadah mean?
To tell.
So why is it called the Haggadah? I would call it the Sipur, the story. Where does that word Haggadah, why does everyone call it the Haggadah? Where does that word come from? Anyone know?
There's a story there. There's a lot of talking and a lot of stuff that's apparently disjointed. Not really, but it looks that way.
Right. So it's not one flow. It's not like a...
telling. It's the act of telling, not the
story. Very good. So look at source number three. So where does the word Haggadah come from? Why did... By the way, this is also just on a tangent. Who wrote the Haggadah? It's a very interesting question. Who wrote the Haggadah?
We don't know.
So who wrote the Haggadah? So we don't know. Because part of the problem is there are many different stages of the Haggadah. We're going to talk about it later today, but really more next week. Part of the Haggadah, they were already saying in the times of the temple, the Beis HaMikdash. Already in the times of the Mishnah, almost 2,000 years ago, the Manishtana, most of the Manishtana, the four questions we asked, are printed in a Mishnah in Tractate Pesachim. Word for word. They were saying that 2,000 years ago. Much of the Haggadah, the text, is from 2,000 years ago. Over time, things got added. It's not clear who added it. It's not clear when it was finally written. But our Haggadah is almost word for word what was found in the times of the Gaonim. In about 900. Someone by the name of Amram Gaon, he was in the period of the Gaonim, before the Rashi, before the Rambam, they were the Rishonim. Before them were called the Gaonim. So the text of the Haggadah that we have today is basically from the year 900, which is an amazing thing. Almost a thousand, more than 1,000 years later, we're still reciting that same text. But why is it called the Haggadah? Why for 1,000 years everyone's calling it the Haggadah? So it's really from source number three. And this is perhaps the most important verse in the whole Seder night. Look at the underlying part. This is the mitzvah of telling over the story of Egypt. The Torah uses the words, V'higadita lebincha, tell over to your child, by Yom HaHulimor, saying, Ba'avor zeh, asa Hashem li, b'seisim mimitzrayim. This is what Hashem did, and because of this, this is what Hashem did for me when I left Egypt. So that same word, the word Haggadah, comes from the word in the Torah, V'higadita lebincha, you should tell over to your child. So from that word, V'higadita, you should tell over, it became known as the Haggadah Shel Pesach. The main part of the Haggadah, which we're going to focus on, is called Magid. Magid from that same word. Haggadah, Magid, all comes from this verse of V'higadita lebincha, tell over to your child. But still it begs the question, why does the Torah use the word V'higadita? If I was writing the Torah, I would have said, V'tomar lebincha, you should say to your son, ... Or V'tisaper, tell the story from the word of Sipur. Why does the Torah use the word V'higadita? What does V'higadita mean? So there are a couple of different explanations, and this I think can really enhance our Pesach with these two explanations. Some say the word V'higadita, that word always connotes, it always means something fresh, something new. The word Amira, to say, can be something old, something new. The word Haggadah always refers to something fresh. Something that was not known to the recipient until that point. Where did they get it from? So look at source number four. This is from the very beginning of the Torah, when Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, when they eat from the forbidden tree. So Adam and Chava were not wearing any clothing. That's how Hashem created the world. And they were not embarrassed. They didn't know anything about good and evil. They didn't know about something being inappropriate. They weren't embarrassed. After they ate from the tree, all of a sudden they're hiding from Hashem. They're embarrassed that they're naked. So when Hashem confronts them, look at source number four, Hashem confronts them and says, Vayomer, and Hashem says, Mi higid lecha. Who told you, ki eirum ata? You weren't supposed to know this. When I created you, you didn't realize that being naked was an embarrassing thing. Mi higid lecha. Who told you that? So you see that the word Haggadah, from this word of Higid, means some new information, something you didn't know before. And there are many explain that our Haggadah is called a Haggadah because the goal is that every year we have to approach Pesach as if we didn't know it before. It has to come with a freshness. The Higadta means when we tell over to our Seder table or to ourselves, it has to be with a freshness. It has to be as if we never heard it before. And that's a very, very important, another Eitz, another advice to be excited about Pesach is to learn new things that we never learned before. I had a tradition, until this year actually, unfortunately, that every Pesach I buy a new Haggadah. Now, I go through about 30 pages in Haggadah every year out of like 500. The same Haggadah can last me probably 10, 15 years. But why do I do it? It's not that I don't have a money tree going in the back of my house. So why do I buy a new Haggadah? Because it gives me a freshness. It's very exciting. Every year there are new ideas. There's a new flavor to it. So this year, unfortunately, unless things change, I haven't got a new one. I went with the old ones this year. But that's just one example, perhaps one advice. To listen to a new class, that it should be with a freshness. And when we give it over to anyone around our table, so even if we've gone through the same Seder before with these same people, it should be fresh. It should be new. If we have children at the table, it should be new to them. Especially young children, it should be fresh to them. It should be new to them. That's how they're going to receive it. That's how they're going to grow from it. But not only children, even adults. We have to find ways of higalta, like we said, the word haggadah means telling something new that they never heard before. That's one goal of Pesach, and hopefully we're going to do, is learn new things. To approach Pesach this year, totally fresh, totally new. Let's conclude in the next 10 minutes. We have one more approach. Look at source number 5. Source number 5 is another answer. What does the word Haggadah mean? What is the shoresh? What's the word of Haggadah? So one approach we just gave was, it means something new. Haggadah means to tell someone something new they never heard before. But there's another time that the word Haggadah is used in the Torah. And that is in source number 5, by something called Bikurim. What's Bikurim? So there's a mitzvah in the Torah that one has to bring the first fruit to the Beis HaMikdash. Every year you bring your first fruit, and you go up, there's a special ceremony, you give the fruits to the Kohen, and you recite a certain text. But what are the words that you recite? Source number 5, right before the underline. V'amarta elav, and you who are bringing up the fruit should say, Higaditi hayom l'Hashem Elokecha. I tell today, I declare today to Hashem my God, Kibati ala aretz, I came to Israel, I came to the temple to bring these bikurim. Now, according to the approach we just said, it doesn't very fit so well. If Haggadah means to tell something new, so it would seem very inappropriate that this person is saying, Higaditi hayom l'Hashem. I'm saying it over to Hashem. Hashem didn't know that you're on your way to come to the temple. Hashem probably knew that. So it must be that Haggadah maybe has a different explanation. And so many commentators say the word Haggadah doesn't mean telling over a story, but it means telling over a story in a way of hoda'ah, of gratitude. You don't need to tell Hashem that you're bringing the fruits to the temple. He knows that. You're telling Hashem in a way of thanking Hashem, in a way of praising Hashem that He allowed you to bring the fruits to the temple. That's what the word Haggadah means. It means telling over a story in a way that has laced in it gratitude. And so perhaps that's really what our Haggadah. Why is our Haggadah called a Haggadah? Because it shouldn't be just a story. It has to be that when we're at our Seder, we tell over the story in a way that it leads to a praising of God. It's not just opening a storybook and reading it from cover to cover. It's a Haggadah. It's not called a Sipur. Sipur means, tell me the facts. How did we get to Egypt? What happened in Egypt? How did we leave Egypt? But perhaps it's called Haggadah because the word Haggadah connotes saying it over, but thanking Hashem. Just like the word Haggadah by Bikurim means, I'm telling Hashem, I'm bringing over the fruits. Really what I'm doing is thanking Hashem. So too, when I'm telling over the story on Pesach, I'm not only, I know the story, I went through the Seder last year also, but I'm experiencing it again to thank Hashem for the story. That perhaps is another explanation of where the word Haggadah comes from.
Is that why so much of Haggadah does not deal with Mitzvah?
You mean, what do you mean? I think most of the Haggadah deals with it, no?
Like Halal.
Halal, good, right. So Halal is very good. Halal near to the end, the last few paragraphs. Right, so much of it is not, Right? You got a very short Seder if you just go through the story of Egypt. You can start at 9:30, be asleep by 10. No Kriyat Shema though, but so instead of 10 o'clock, 9:59 you can be. Right, so to the Seder, and that's, I think a lot of what we spoke about today answered that question. Because we're not just remembering the historical facts. We said we're thinking about the future.
Right.
So we talk about the future. We're thanking Hashem. Mm-hmm. We're declaring our Emunah in Hashem. It's not just remembering historical facts. Okay, yes, please.
Just an observation, both Torah excerpts that mention the word Haggadah are followed by Hayom or Vayom.
Like today.
Today, this day or that day.
Yes, what do you say?
Cases.
So what's the explanation? You should write this down. You have your first Chiddush, novel idea. Beautiful. Okay, so you have to think about it.
Bringing it to here and now, the present. Yeah.
Very good. So you have to write that down. You have to... No, you should write it. Buy a notebook and write it down. It's a beautiful idea.
The concept that everything in the Torah is applicable to today, too. So when you say, like, I got that Hayom, and we think, like, okay, so they're talking about specifically that day, but we are now remember. It goes back to what you said from the beginning. We're required to remember to see that in every day. And
it's relevant today. No, it's not a historical event.
It's relevant today. It's not, and we're required to remember it.
Right.
Day.
Beautiful.
And interesting.
Right. Yeah. So let's conclude. If anyone wants to leave, I'm not going to take it offensively, but we're going to conclude now just to go through briefly, just to get our bearings for next week, the 15 steps of the Seder. So there are 15 steps of the Seder. Many people sing it as a song. I'm not going to attempt to sing it now. I don't want everyone to leave early. But there are 15 steps of the Seder. You have it listed over here. Starts with Kadesh Urchat. So let's go through it one by one, briefly, just so that we have some bearings. We speak next week more in the text, just so we know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And these 15 steps, actually, are also a very old source. Many assume that Rashi, the great commentator Rashi, who lived in the year about 1040 to 1105, they don't know exactly, but around then, so almost 1,000 years ago, he was the one who came up with these 15 steps. So it wasn't that Maxwell House needed to organize their Agadah and they chose 15 chapters. These are very significant. It's not a coincidence that we had these 15 steps. Also, the number 15, even on a deeper level, in Kabbalistic or in the secrets of the Torah, are very significant. There were 15 steps leading up to the Beis HaMikdash. There are 15 chapters in Tehillim that start with the word Shir HaMa'alot. So the number 15 is very special. It always connotes going up and trying to achieve something. So these are the 15 steps of the Seder. Let's go with quickly, and then we'll delve more into it next week. So first is Kaddish. So Kaddish is interesting because every Shabbos and Yontiv meal, we make a Kiddush. Every Shabbos and Yontiv. Mm-hmm. Now Kaddish on Pesach is unique because it serves two purposes. Not only is it making Kiddush because it's a holiday or a festival or Shabbos, but it's one of the four cups of wine that we drink on the Seder night. Throughout the Seder, we drink four cups of wine. So the first cup is both the Kiddush we make on every Shabbos and Yontiv, every festival, but it's also one of the four cups. And that's why throughout the rest of the year, most people have the custom that one person makes Kiddush and they drink it. Some people like drinking the wine from the one making Kiddush, but you don't really need to drink the wine on a regular Shabbos. One person can make the Kiddush. But on Pesach night, everyone has to drink because it's not only the Kiddush because it's a festival, it's one of the four cups of wine. And just like I have to drink the other three cups, I can't be Yotzi, I can't fulfill my obligation by you drinking the wine for me. So too, since Kaddish serves a dual purpose, therefore everyone has to drink the cup of wine. Urchatz and Karpas is very interesting. We wash our hands, we're not eating bread, we wash our hands and then we dip a vegetable into salt water and eat it. So first, why are we dipping a vegetable into salt water? So the answer is, and there's going to be many, many answers too, a lot of questions at the Seder night. What's the answer?
Because we're slaves.
No, you're too deep for that. Too deep for me.
Keep the kids
interested. Keep, right, make the kids ask questions. That's the halacha. So many things we do is to keep the people awake. Like maybe next week I should bring in some vegetables to dip right here. Like why are you dipping vegetables in the middle of the class?
But
it's an appetizer. So the real reason is because we want the children or people around to ask, normally you make Kiddush and then you go and eat the challah.
Right.
Why are you dipping? In my family, I use potatoes, but everyone has different customs, different minhagim, celery, okay. Why are you dipping a piece of celery in salt water? It's a pretty bad appetizer. You should have bought me some salmon or like a gefilte fish or something.
Yeah.
So that is karpas, to get the children to ask questions. So why are we washing our hands? Why do we wash our hands? Right, good. Right, very good. So there is a halacha that some actually do it now, but when the Beis HaMikdash was around, any time you were eating something that was dipped in a liquid, you had to wash your hands to purify them. Because once a food gets wet, this is getting a little bit complicated, but once a food gets wet, it has the ability to contract impurity, tumah. So you have to wash your hands before in order to prevent that from happening. So why are we doing it the Seder night? Throughout the rest of the year, we don't do that. When I dip my Oreo in milk, I don't wash my hands. But it's not a joke. When the temple is going to come, hopefully, and you want to dip your Oreo in the milk, you have to wash your hands first. Mm. Or you want to dip your vegetable into salad dressing even. But we don't do that the rest of the year, most of us. So why are we doing it on Pesach? So this is another example where we're trying to look forward to the temple, prospectively. Mm. That when the temple was around, we had to wash our hands before we dipped any food in liquid. So now, today, we don't have the temple, and we don't have to do that really, but we're commemorating that. We're thinking to the future, we're remembering the past and thinking to the future. So because we had to dip the vegetable, we wash our hands. An important rule is, you don't make a bracha on this washing. Later on, we're going to wash our hands to eat the bread, but here for karpas, when you wash your hands, you do not make a bracha. You wash your hands like you would for bread, two and then two. You dry your hands, but you don't make a bracha. Yeah. Okay, we continue now to number four, yachatz. We break the middle matzah. Why are we breaking a matzah? Anyone know? Why do we break the matzah? Right, so the half that we're going to put in for the afikoman, but why are we breaking it? So part of matzah, which is very interesting, is that when we're eating matzah, we're celebrating two things. What are we commemorating when we eat matzah?
It says the bread of affliction.
Good. Right. Very good. Very good. Mm. So why, if I ask most people, why do we eat matzah on Pesach?
Because we're glad
to admit
it was pizza.
That what?
Because we don't want to admit it was really pizza.
But what was pizza? What are we commemorating? What are we commemorating?
The Exodus.
What about the Exodus?
The speed.
They didn't have enough time for the dough to break. Whether it was a laffa or a matzah, I don't care.
But that doesn't make sense either.
That why?
Because Paro came out.
So they had a bunch of hours.
And Moshe said, we're not leaving until the sun is out. So there's plenty of time to bake the bread. I don't buy it.
How much time does it bake challah? Do you bake challah, George? How long does it take to bake challah?
An hour.
Very easy.
An hour. I don't know if that was on their... Listen, they were slaves for 210 years in Egypt. I don't know if the first thing on their mind was, you know, to bake bread. They do say, this is a joke, so it's a joke, that the Torah says, v'gam tseida... something like that. They didn't take any food with them. So people say a joke that what's the biggest miracle on Pesach? Not that the 10 plagues, not that the Hashem put the sea, but you have these Jewish women who left to a trip without food on them. That's the biggest miracle in the world. So they didn't have time. They took some bread. That what?
It's in our DNA with
food. Right. Yeah. So why didn't they plan in advance? They're doing a lot that night. They were also getting ready to leave and say, why don't they have enough time? But fine, good question. But one reason we eat matzah is because they didn't have enough time. But another reason is, like we said before, that apparently when they were in Egypt, they were also eating matzah, which is a very fascinating concept. The same matzah, we're commemorating two things. One, that this is the bread that we ate when we were slaves, because Egyptians didn't give us nice bread that rose. We had to eat that. And also we're commemorating that the freedom. So the same matzah commemorates freedom and slavery. But for the slavery portion, we break our bread. It's a bread of affliction. Slaves don't get a nice piece of bread. The master throws them a piece of bread. So we break the matzah in half to commemorate that it's the bread of affliction as well. Then we move on, Magid. Magid is the bulk of the Seder night, the bulk of the text. That's all the telling over the story of Egypt. That's what we're going to go through the next 2 weeks. Rachza, then we wash our hands. This time, we do make a bracha, because we're about to eat bread. The next two are motzi and matzah, which are really two different things. Because when we take the matzah and are about to eat it, we make two brachas. We make a bracha of hamotzi lechem min haaretz, like we do throughout the rest of the year when you want to eat bread. You also make a second bracha of al achilas matzah. Just like when you shake a lulav, you make a bracha make a blessing on the lulav. So there are two blessings. So that's motzi. Motzi is the normal blessing you make, hamotzi lechem in haaretz. And matzah is that second blessing that we make a bracha al achilas matzah. Hashem commanded us to make a bracha before we do a mitzvah. Let's now turn the page. Let's conclude with the final number of simanim, of steps. Maror, we eat the bitter herbs. So this is also a little bit of a misnomer. You know, a lot of people out there say tonight, they have horseradish, you know, the nice white, sharp horseradish, and then they have the lettuce. The people ask, you want the lettuce or you want the maror? That's what people say. Do you want the real maror or you want the lettuce? So that's a little bit of a misnomer, because the Mishnah actually lists five things that you could use for maror, and lettuce is high up on the list. Lettuce is really the real maror. The horseradish might actually be a lower category of maror than the lettuce. So when someone tells you, won't make you feel bad, oh, do you want the real maror or the lettuce? Tell them, no, I learned that the real maror is the lettuce. So people have lettuce, people have, you know, the horseradish is also good. Korech, what do we do on korech? So we have a sandwich, and this is one of the proofs they want to bring that probably the matzah was, like the Israeli Sephardim use, Sephardim matzahs are like sort of like lafas that you have in Israel, they're soft pitas. Because how do you make a sandwich out of matzah? You try to make a sandwich out of matzah, it never goes well. That's why my Haggadah every year is full of prum, because how do you make a sandwich out of a piece of matzah? It doesn't really work so well, it breaks. So some people say it's a proof that the Sephardim, they use soft bread, but we make a sandwich of matzah and maror, commemorating, there was one opinion of Hillel, that's how you were supposed to eat the Korban Pesach, so we commemorate that. Shulchan Orech is a festive meal, again, it's the Yontif at the end of the day, so just like every other Yontif, we go home and have a nice meal, so to Pesach we have a nice meal. Then we have Tzafun. What's Tzafun? We eat another piece of matzah, this time the matzah commemorates the Korban Pesach. One of the things that we're lacking, we're really lacking at the Seder night, is the Korban Pesach. The staple of Pesach in the temple was bringing the Korban Pesach, bringing the lamb of the Korban Pesach. That was the entire holiday. That's why it's called Pesach. So we, unfortunately, another reason to daven, you know, for the temple to be rebuilt, we don't have that. So we commemorate that by eating the matzah, which at the end of the meal commemorates eating the Korban Pesach. And the Korban Pesach also was not supposed to be eaten when you were very, very hungry. It was supposed to be eaten after you were a little bit full. So to here, we have our meal, and then we do tzafon, we eat the afikomen. Finally, final three things, we have berich, we have to bench. We ate bread, we have to bench. Halel, which is similar to what we do in shul, very interesting why we do halel at night. And then nirtza are the final prayer, that's where the fun paragraphs, chad gadya, the one little goat, who knows one, I know one, that's where, if you're still up for it, that's for a lot of people the exciting part of the Haggadah. Now just look at the very bottom of the two pictures, and this is where we're going to conclude with this. So one of the main things people get confused with is the Seder plate. So the Seder plate actually has a lot of different traditions, so there's no right or wrong. I put on for you, there's two main traditions of how to set up a Seder plate. One is the Ramah, which is the classic Ashkenazic rabbi, the Posek, and the Arizal, which is really, I think a lot of people adopted this approach of the Arizal, which is more Api Kabbalah, based on the secrets of the Torah. So let's look at the one on the side where it says the Arizal. Let's go through quickly all of those things on the Seder plate just to appreciate what they are. So we'll start from the top. Beitza. Why do we have an egg? Why is there an egg on our Seder plate? And also an egg and what is Zeroah? That's the roasted shank bone. So why do we have an egg and a roasted shank bone?
There were two sacrifices.
Right, good. So there are two sacrifices. The Zeroah, the roasted shank bone, is commemorating, it's supposed to remind us of the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach had to be roasted. The Beitza is another cooked item, a cooked egg, because there was a second sacrifice you brought called the Chagiga. Every holiday you brought a sacrifice, including Pesach. So really two sacrifices were brought on Pesach. One is the Chagiga, one is the Pesach. So we have two cooked items. One is the Beitza and one is the Zeroa. But like you mentioned, it is important, you shouldn't eat the Zeroa. Even if you make a delicious shank bone and you have such a desire to eat it, you shouldn't eat it on Pesach night. We shouldn't have roasted meat on Pesach night. It's an important halacha. We don't want to make believe like we're having the Korban Pesach, which is roasted. So we shouldn't roast any meat. Vegetables, do you want to roast your vegetables? Roast your vegetables. Roast anything else you want, but we shouldn't have roasted meat. We shouldn't eat it on Pesach night. Then the middle of the maror, which we explained, according to Arizal, he put horseradish there. You'll see why in a second. Karpas is the vegetable that you dipped, either a potato or celery or radish. On the side is charoses. So haroses is a mixture. Everyone has different customs. Yeah. Apple and cinnamon and wine. That's what we dip the maror in before we eat it. That's called haroses. And the bottom is chazeres. Chazeres is lettuce. So on the plate of the Arizal, he actually had maror, which is probably the horseradish. And he had also chazeres. Fine. So that's going to conclude tonight. I just want to conclude one final thought that there are a lot of minhagim, a lot of traditions on Pesach night. Maybe throughout the entire year, we don't have a night with more family traditions. A lot of people have traditions. My family eats a potato. So when I go to my in-law's house for Pesach, I always feel very strange eating the radish, the celery. That's not my family tradition. And it's not by accident that Pesach night is full of tradition. Like we started with, the whole point of Pesach is passing on our tradition to the next generation. And so that's why it's not a coincidence that so much of the Pesach night is full of tradition. People have different tunes for the different paragraphs. People use karpas, different vegetables. The fascinating story that someone went to the Seder of the Chafetz Chaim. And the Chafetz Chaim, you know, the custom we'll talk about, when you do the 10 plagues, when you recite them, Dam, Tzvardeya, blood and frogs, you spill out a little wine on the plate. And then you refill it. So the Chafetz Chaim wrote a sefer called the Mishnah Berurah, which is an important Jewish work of law. So he gives three different options of how you should take out the wine. Either you should pour the wine out without your finger, with a cup. You should use your thumb, or you should use your index finger. That's three opinions, different reasons why. So someone went to the Chafetz Chaim, and they went to a Seder by him. They were by him for the Seder. And they saw that he was using his pinky. So they asked him, you gave three approaches in your book, and you didn't fulfill any of them. Chafetz Chaim said, yeah, but this is what my father did. Yeah. My father used his pinky. Yeah. So maybe I think the correct approach is pouring it with a cup. Maybe I think the correct approach is using your index finger. My father used the pinky, so I'm going to use the pinky on Seder night. Because yeah. The whole point of the Seder night is to pass tradition on from us, from what we said, from number 133 to 134. So hopefully this wasn't too much information. I know it was a lot. This was an introduction. Next week, hopefully, we'll delve into the text of the Haggadah and come prepared for the holiday of Pesach. And if there's any questions, please feel free.